Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Folks, we've come to the end. This is the last episode of Black Ballad Presents The Survival Guide, the parenting podcast that looks at motherhood through the lens of Black women in Britain and is ultimately here to help us survive and thrive through this wild, wild ride of parenting. Now for the final instalment, you know we had to give you something just a little bit special. So today's episode is a candid conversation between me, Jen Della Benson, head of editorial at Black Ballad, and Toby Oradain, CEO and co-founder of Black Ballad, aka my boss. We cover a lot of ground in our conversation. We discuss women's health, endometriosis, giving birth during the peak of the first COVID lockdown, being a working mum, cultural expectations, representation, and so much more. And you will hear our kids protesting in the background, but you should know the drill by now, listeners. Okay? Let's dive straight in.
My name is Toby Oradain. I am the founder of Black Ballad, a publication for and by Black women in Britain and around the world. That's what I am and who I am.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so my first question is, when you were younger, what yeah. kind of idea of motherhood did you have? Like, did you have a plan set out? Did you have any thoughts at all? Because some girls might not have been thinking about it.
Oh, when I was younger, I literally thought that motherhood was about the mum being at home and like making food and not having a job, because my mum didn't work for the first kind of couple of years of my life. I think she got a job like when I was like maybe like around 7 or 6. So I was so used to not seeing her work. So I literally just thought that like, yeah, dads went out to work and mums cooked and cleaned, because that was literally like how my family was. That was the setup at home. And then when I got like a little bit older, maybe like I'd say about 10, I wanted to have a family. I knew that like being a mum was something that I wanted to do. Like I wanted to look after somebody. I wanted to look after, you know, a real life doll. You know what I mean? And I thought, yeah. Oh, everyone, this is so embarrassing. I thought that everyone had babies at 21. I was like, yes. I think my cousin had her baby at 21. I was like, everyone has a baby at 21, right? That was how I thought of motherhood, that like mums cooked and cleaned and stayed home. And then when my mum got a job, I just thought that everyone had babies at 21. Yeah, it was like what I thought.
So when you hit 21, how did you feel? Were you like, by then you were over it, or you were like, oh, I'm not on track to do what
when I was 21, I was going traveling with like two of my best friends around America, and I was like, I don't want to be with anybody, like I just want to, you know, I want to get my 2-1 and I want to travel and I want to do my internship. And at 21 I met my husband and he came and messed up all the plans, and like we were dating for like 3 months, and then I went traveling for a month, and then I was kind of like, I think like this is the person I'm gonna like spend my life with. And that wasn't the plan at 21. I totally didn't want to think about kids and relationships, and then here I was at 21 thinking I was gonna settle down with someone. So yeah, it was a bit of a weird one,
a bit inconvenient.
Yeah, it was.
Did you guys kind of talk about having kids from the start, or was it like a bit too intense? Like, what was like, did you kind of plan, or was it more like, let's see how things go?
Like, do you know what? Like, oh, this is getting personal. The first conversation I had with my husband was like 6 hours on the phone, and we spoke about everything, and we spoke about our dreams. We both wanted kids. We both discussed really we both discussed names for boys. That's very, very strange because we have a little girl, and funny enough, we both liked the same name for a boy, which is very, very weird. Imagine like meeting someone, you haven't even met them, like you've spoken over Facebook, and then you're talking about kids in your first conversation. It was a really weird one. So yeah, we both knew we wanted kids, and like we have very different like sort of like family backgrounds. Like he's the eldest of four, I've got like three siblings, but like we've never all grown up together, so like I've grown up as an only child. But we both kind of had the same dreams and ambitions when it came to kids, and we both knew we wanted them. We just knew that we wanted them further down the line. By the time I was 21, I said I didn't want a kid in my 20s. I wanted a kid when I was 30. Be careful what you say, because I had had my baby at 30. So I was pushing the goalpost back when it came to kids, like constantly.
Did you feel any pressure around when you were going to have kids from like family or friends? Or was it very much like, I'm going to do my own thing, I'm not that bothered?
You know what? I had an operation for endometriosis, and like early on in my marriage, I had like a lot of health issues, like a lot, like in terms of like I was on the floor with periods, like my husband had to carry me to like have a bath. I was like in an immense amount of pain. And like I remember coming to my doctor, and he was like, if I have another operation, you're limiting your chances of kids. I was told that it was going to be really hard to have kids. So in the back of my mind, I do this thing, like when I think something's not going to happen for me, I like be like, it's not going to happen for me. So although we wanted kids, it kind of felt like it wasn't going to happen for me, because like my doctor was like, you know, like you're in a lot of pain, like there's not really, operating is going to make you like slim down your chance of having kids, but then your chances of having kids are low because of endometriosis, which is false information, by the way. So I was shocked last August when I had a little surprise in my stomach, because I was just like, yeah, it's like not going to be straightforward. Yeah, like, let's just enjoy. No, yeah, let's just have hot girl summer out here. Do you know what I mean? And then come August, I was like, oh, whoa. So yeah, that was it. Like we wanted it, but I didn't think it was going to happen as quickly as it did, because doctors aren't the best at telling the truth, it seems. So yeah, that's kind of that.
Yeah, so let's talk about that in terms of, obviously we've covered a lot about health kind of stuff on Black Ballads, and especially to do with motherhood and health outcomes, but also just in general, like Black women's health when it comes to doctors is a bit touch and go. It feels like it depends on the doctor that you get, whether they kind of know what they're talking about, or that's not to disrespect doctors as a profession, but it seems that doctors are not necessarily maybe educated in the way that they need to be about Black women's health issues. Like that whole process where your doctor's essentially saying like it might not happen for you, how did you feel with your healthcare and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, like my healthcare and my endometriosis has been pretty dire. I remember it took me 3.5 years to get a hospital appointment, because like my doctors kept giving me pills. They kept saying that, am I sure? Like, am I not making it up? My periods, I'd be vomiting all the time. I'd be like really, really ill. I remember once I was so ill that I had to chuck my house keys out to a friend for her to come into the house and help me like literally get off the floor. Like I was like that ill with periods. And then I finally got a hospital appointment, and my doctor was like, yeah, there's nothing wrong. You're just kind of being a hypochondriac. Don't like make this stuff up, you're wasting my time. And I remember I was about to leave the hospital appointment, and my mum came in, and I think this is really worth saying. So basically the woman that's put me at my, who's my mum, is white, and she came late to the appointment, and she came in and she said, no, she was like, she has been suffering, like we are not leaving until you like literally like take her seriously. And he took her seriously.
Oh my gosh.
It just shows you. And then I remember he got a second opinion. He brought someone else in, another doctor. Another doctor was like, okay, I think she should have an operation. And I remember him being like, oh, she's going to waste her time. Like, there's nothing there. I had my operation for endometriosis, and they literally found it in my, like, in like the lining of like my womb and stuff like that. They literally came out and showed me like the scans, like of where it was. And I felt really vindicated, because the fact was, like, I was like, oh my God, like for the last like 5 years, like, you know, 2 years before I actually started like seeing somebody about it, and 3 years I was in the kind of system, like trying to get an appointment at the hospital. Like, I was like, I'm not crazy. Like, it's real. I felt vindicated that I was right. But at the same time, it was really disheartening, because I knew that I never would have got that operation if my mum was black. Like, I got that operation. I got taken seriously because my mum happens to be white. Every time I think about it, it's kind of like, I will never be able to advocate for my daughter the way my mum can advocate for me. And like, not even to like disrespect my mum, but my mum's working class, do you know what I mean? Like, it's literally just her race. It's not because she's like middle class and like has like a super posh accent. Do you know, she's a working class white woman who literally was just able to kind of throw her toys out the pram and get her way. And if I did that for my daughter, I would be called, like, you know, the angry black woman, or like the mum with the attitude. I think that's so scary about the health system when I think about it like that. And to think kind of that I wouldn't maybe be able to have kids because no one was like taking me seriously, or people were kind of, even afterwards, I was still getting a bit of pain. People were like dismissing the fact that I was in so much pain. I don't like the health system. Like, I avoid it like the plague. I only go if I really have to. And I think there's a lot of work to be done around like women's reproductive health. People don't care about women's health, and I will stand on the rooftops and shout about that. The healthcare system does not care about women's health in the way that it should, and I really stand by that.
Yeah, that's really illuminating, the fact that it was essentially just the fact that you happen to have a white mum that enabled you to get an operation. Like, that is actually kind of insane to think about that. But also, so obviously for the HuffPost takeover, you wrote about your experience kind of like giving birth and how it wasn't what you wanted.
Yeah.
It wasn't how you imagined it. It wasn't what you wanted at all, especially given that it was kind of like COVID. So for people who haven't read, if you can just give us a quick summary, as much detail as you want, to be honest.
So I gave birth in the height of COVID. I gave birth in the first week of April, and I had a long labor. I was in labor for nearly 60 hours from start to finish. So from the jump, it wasn't what I wanted, because I was on hands and knees praying. You know, I had the scripture that, like, Hebrew women, I was going to have a quick delivery. So I don't even know where my prayers were, because I'd never in my life thought that I was gonna have a 60-hour labor. I was like exercising through my like pregnancy. My husband was like, your labor will be quick, man. Like, you know, on my due date, we went for like a 4-hour walk, and then I was in labor for 60 hours. And I felt really alone in my like my labor, because I went in with my husband and he stayed with me for the first 2 hours, and then they said, like, you know, because I'm going down to like triage, that he couldn't like come in with me or stay with me. And then, you know, I was kind of having contractions, and then I finally got moved back up to labourhood like about 24 hours later. My husband was allowed to be with me, and my baby's heartbeat was kind of slowly progressing into distress. I was getting really tired. I wasn't getting past 4 centimetres. And then they was like, you know, I went into hospital on Tuesday and gave birth on Thursday evening. And I think on Thursday afternoon, they was like, you're going to need a C-section. And they was like, your husband's not going to be able to come in with you. And I cried. Like, I cried. I was bawling. I was like, I can't do this by myself. Like, I can't. I mean, I'm not really doing anything. Do you know what I mean? I'm laying on the table getting slashed and diced. But one, I never thought I'd be having a C-section. Two, I think the thought of just doing it so alone was just like not what I imagined. And, you know, I was being wheeled in the corridor, and I remember because when you're in labor for so long, your temperature rises, and that's just a natural sort of side effect of being in labor for so long. But it's also a symptom of COVID. So like, they was like, you're a COVID suspect. It's highly unlikely you've got COVID, but you are a COVID suspect. And I remember waiting in the corridor, waiting to go into theater, and the anesthesiologist was like, why is this COVID suspect here? Like, get her out, move her. And I remember another nurse, being a midwife, being like, you know, this woman is all alone. She has no partner with her. We need to give her some compassion and, you know, be professional. And I was really scared because I was kind of thinking, my baby's heartbeat's in distress. This lady's holding everything up because she's having a tantrum. Like, this is not how it should be. Mm. And I think one thing, you know, me and my husband have spoken a little bit about, like, my labour experience. And we've said, like, the politics of what goes on when someone's giving birth is it's just not what anyone should see. You know, the woman that's pregnant or person that's pregnant and, like, their partner, they should not be seeing the politics that goes on within, like, a labour unit. And, like, before I went into labour, I was just looking at this woman that was screaming about the fact that I was, like, a problem. And the fact that she was going to stick a needle in my back was not, you know, filling me with confidence.
Yeah.
So then I eventually got wheeled into theatre. I was like on a table with like a mask like over my face, and like the mask was so tight, like I felt like I couldn't even breathe. And my baby was born, and she didn't cry. She didn't cry when she was born, and I could hear people like kind of talking and shouting actually that she wasn't crying. And I remember just being on the table and just being, I don't know why I get so emotional about it, but I just remember praying about it. And then I remember asking someone, how's my baby? And no one was answering me. And I felt really distressed. And then finally, someone brought her over and they showed me her. And then they were just like, yeah, she's going to like neonatal. And I didn't see her for like 24 hours. So it wasn't the experience that I wanted. I remember coming home and I was just like, I'd never do it again. Like, I'd never do it again. She's worth it, but it was just so far removed from what like I wanted. So yeah, it wasn't the best experience. Only I can get emotional on a pod, my own podcast.
No, it's fine because yeah. I think there's definitely something to be said about those scriptures that everyone gives like pregnant women about the Hebrew women, da, 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 all that kind of thing. I remember someone gave me this book about like spiritual childbirth and how, you know, how you shouldn't be in pain and all this kind of stuff. And I read it and I was like, yeah, my labor's going to be great. And then my first labor was absolutely not that at all. And if I'm honest, I think that it contributed to my postnatal depression because I had this feeling like, oh, I failed. My body failed me. I was supposed to do this thing. It was supposed to be so easy and swift and smooth, but no, I had to go into theater and da 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 da, and I didn't give birth properly the way that women should give. Like, it really like messed with my psychology for like a while, and I felt like, I don't know, there's just so much to be said about the kind of narratives around how we give birth and the expectations, and just the fact that, you know what, you could do everything right and your birth doesn't go the way that you want it to go, and that is life.
It's so true. And you know, it's a very kind of cultural thing. And you know, I can only speak from like a Nigerian Christian perspective, that everyone's like placing scripture on you, laying hands on you, and like your birth can go so far like smoothly. And I think the only person that said to me, there's no shame in having an epidural or a C-section, was an Asian woman who I met at a party of a friend. So she was a friend of a friend, and she was a Christian. And she's the only person I think about it that said to me, there's no shame in having an epidural or a C-section. It's like, I had epidural with all three of my kids. I think she had a C-section with one, and she said, don't let no one shame you into that. And I thought, that's actually true, that there's a big cultural kind of stigma about giving birth naturally, I think, in our community that we don't talk about. And even like the language of like, you know, I remember like I was at my husband's 30th, and his cousin came and said, are you planning to give birth naturally? And I was kind of like, well, what do you mean? Like, isn't it all natural? And he's like, you know, naturally or C-section. And I was like, wow, like even kind of the language that we use can kind of make you feel like you failed. And like, I was exactly the same. Like when I think about it in my mind, when I spoke briefly about it to my husband, it was like, I feel like I failed, like, because I didn't push her out. I wasn't able to get past 4 centimeters. And I think that is something that we need to talk about in our communities, about the language of how we talk about, you know, women that give birth. And like, you know, scriptures should be there to comfort. And I think we need to kind of stop kind of just using scripture just kind of be like, you're gonna have the perfect birth. It should be, what scriptures are you using to kind of follow up after your birth and to kind of get you through the hard times? And I don't think that was a conversation that I really had. It was just, I'm sending you the Hebrew woman's scripture, there's a book about giving birth, about, you know, being a Christian or whatever. And it to be honest, it was a little unhelpful, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I think it's very unhelpful because it doesn't take into account the fact that different women have different births at different points in their lives. And like some, like I have friends who giving birth and pregnancy is just such a breeze for them. Like one of them said that she'd like no pain, did it? And it's like, okay, that's great. That works for some people. It doesn't work for me. It didn't work for me. I needed pain relief. And there's not, and it's like literally like when you actually think about childbirth as a process, it's even if your birth goes the smoothest, it's still a life or death situation. Do you get what I mean? Like one wrong move and tragedy could strike, even if everything was smooth. So I definitely think we just need to take all of that pressure off of, like, are women healthy? Are women safe? Are they cared for? Is their mental health in a great place? Are they getting the medical care that they need? Do they have someone to advocate for them? Like, those are the only things that essentially matter. Because people do want to know all the details, like, oh, so are you going to have painkillers? Are you going to do this? Are you going to breastfeed immediately after? Like, all of this kind of, like, really pressurizing stuff.
The breastfeeding conversation, Jesus, that deserves a podcast of its own, because the pressure that you get to breastfeed, and, it took me a few weeks to kind of be able to breastfeed my baby, but like the calls I had from, you know, from Nigeria, from here, like, am I breastfeeding? Like, this day never, I had someone say, just stick it in her mouth and she'll take it. And I was like, that's not quite how it works.
That's not how it works.
The pressure, oh my God, it's ridiculous. There's so much pressure around, I think, having a baby and doing it the right way, that it can kind of be off-putting to do it again, if I'm honest.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, that's kind of like how I feel. And people are like, oh, so when's the third one coming? I'm like, it's not coming, like, I'm done. And they're like, oh no. And it's like, what, like, it's, yeah, you lot don't make it sound great. I mean, having a third baby, like, do you get what I mean? Like, everyone's, who called it womb watching? Someone called it womb watching. Like, it's not great, it's not encouraging. Like, just let people do what they need to do. So how have you found your foot? How long has it been now? What,
nearly 5 months. You need 5 months.
Yeah. How have you found this, like, I guess they call it like the fourth trimester, like that period immediately after?
I think one thing I've had to learn, I think my daughter's forced me to really understand who I am as a person. And that's been a really interesting experience. I have to say that I've really loved being, I'm gonna say I love being her mum, not just being a mum, but I love being her mum. I say that she's like the biggest distraction, but the biggest motivation. You know better than anyone, Jen. Like, I was like, yeah, I'm not gonna work. I'm gonna like have time off. I'm really gonna just like chill at home. And like in my head, I thought I was gonna be doing like I love to cook. I thought I'd be cooking. I thought, I'd be like super organized and cleaning. I was lying to myself. I hate cleaning. My husband doesn't clean. I don't even know why I had it in my head that I was going to be doing it all like perfect wife and mum shit. Like, I was like, had it all planned out. And then she came and I was just like, I love her to bits and she's amazing. And when she's awake, she has all my attention. But when she's asleep, I just like to work. Like, I like being a working mum. I like my job. And I like having my child on my chest sleeping and me typing on a laptop. There's no better feeling for me in the world, like having the best of both worlds. So I've had to really learn in the fourth trimester who I am and not kind of, I guess, being the mum that I thought I should be. I've also had to learn about the things that are good for like my sort of soul and spirit. An example is we started watching Mad Men. I think I said, after, I gave birth, it was something on Netflix, it was like, yeah, let's watch Mad Men. And I realized it's a very depressing show. And I was like, it was like, I can only describe, like, watching it felt like someone was pushing down in my mind. And I was feeling really sad when watching it. And like, even certain albums, like, I love Neo, but her album was very emotional. So I had to stop listening to that album. I had to stop. And please, like, if Neo's like listening to this, like, I love you to bits, but like, I'm not trying to like slate you and all that. But like, I just like, I'm just so invested in her album. And I was just kind of like, yeah, I can't listen to that album for a few weeks. And I can't watch Mad Men for a few weeks. So like, I've been really watching a lot of like Modern Family, because like, it's super just like chilled out and like upbeat. I watched like a lot of like romantic comedies, and like, I was just very careful about watching my mental health and what I was consuming. So I gave my best chance, gave myself the best chance of not having postnatal depression. And of course it's more than entertainment, but what I could do, what I did, and working actually made me feel like good about myself. I remember I was like, you know, I'm gonna try and have a like, you know, a week where I don't do anything. And I kind of felt really useless. And like, I was kind of feeling like, who am I? Like, I'm my baby's mum, but then who am I without my work? And I think it made me realize how big a part of my work makes up my identity. And that's why I did choose to kind of work. And I, you know, we had to, my husband and I had to have a conversation because he kind of sat me down and was like, why are you working? Like, you should be resting at a C-section, this, that, and the other. And I said, you know what, being at home, being locked up in COVID, I can't see friends. This is giving me some self-esteem. This is making me happy. And he totally got it after I explained like why I was working. So I've loved the fourth trimester because I've been able to do it on my own terms. I haven't had to, I guess that's the thing with COVID, because we were so restricted, like nobody saw or held our baby for the first 3 months of her life. Because nobody could kind of inflict on how I should be as a mum, I think that made it a really enjoyable fourth trimester, because I know like, you know, once me and my husband had that conversation about why I'm working, and like, you know, I kind of shifted what I was watching and taking in. I've enjoyed it. I've loved it. I love being with her. I love being around her. I love the routine that we're, you know, it's not a perfect routine and we don't get it right every day, but kind of the routine of being with her in the morning, working a bit in the day, going for a walk, and then I work when she's sleeping, and like what I watch, it's made it like the best experience of my life.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, that's nice. That's really nice. Thanks. To hear. And you're like the probably one of the only people that I've ever heard say that they can't wait to get back to work, like all time, to be like a working mum. But I guess you're explaining, like, obviously work is really, and you get to do something that you love, so it's not like you're going to work for like pagans or whatever.
You know, I work for myself, do you know what I mean?
And yeah,
it helps. So, you know, I've created the job that I love, and obviously, you know, my work, our work, is about helping Black women become the best versions of themselves. So I know that my work is even tied to her self-esteem, do you know what I mean? My husband even said something today, and he was like, I really hope this child loves herself as a Black woman, because the work that we put into other Black women, he was like, God, please let us make sure we're doing it for her. So
yeah,
it's kind of tied to, you know, like her, and like, so I do love work, but you know, the separation anxiety, because my mum will be looking after her in the afternoons when I go back to work, you know, in later on in the year. And I'm really worried and conscious about being separated from her. Like, my mum and I are trialing it now, so I do my 2 days and, like, you know, working, and my mum takes her from 1 till 7, and when she's not around, I'm like to my husband, I miss her, do you miss her, I miss her, do you miss her? And he's like, yeah, but I've got to do work. And I'm like, I miss her so much. Oh, I can smell her. Like, I wonder what she's doing. I FaceTime my mum. And then I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? And I'm like, let me see her. So I am, that separation anxiety, it's already going on. Like, I'm like, she's my best friend. Like, she really is. And like, she's like a 4-month-old baby. And like, I'm like, we're best friends. So I'm eager to get back to work, but I don't want to be separated from her. And you can't, and the truth is, you just can't do it all when you know your baby's around. You kind of have to make a choice and decision. And like, not only do I love my work, the truth of the matter is, I've got bills to pay. And if I don't do my work, I can't pay my bills. So it is what it is in that way, I guess.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you need time away from your kids to miss them. You need the opportunity to miss your kids to appreciate them more. Otherwise, anyway, I've got two very high energy children. So yeah, definitely.
And my baby's not on the move yet. I think it'll be different when she starts crawling and walking all of that. She right now
she's and trying to type on your laptop.
Yes. Although she does bang the laptop and like, yeah, she's slowly ruining my husband's Apple Watch. So like, she's on her way there.
Oh no. So when you do go back to work full time, how are you guys going to manage childcare, and what kind of decisions and considerations did you have when it came to choosing where your daughter will go, who she'll be spending her time with?
Okay, so when we found out I was pregnant, we actually spoke quite a bit about childcare, and I know that my husband said that he wanted our daughter to go to nursery when she was a little bit older, so like 18 months too, just so she can start kind of communicating and we can kind of know that she's happy and like healthy and safe in an environment that we choose to put her. And you know, my mum is kind of like getting older and like works part-time, and she was very vocal and being like, I'm happy to do childcare for you guys. Like, also, you know, we're a young couple that has a business together, so like financially it was a godsend when my mum offered that childcare. And I think, you know, we kind of thought, should we take her up on it or not? And then my cousin said something that really, really made my mind up for me. She said that when she went to visit nurseries, she saw a nursery teacher wipe a table with a cloth and then wipe a child's face. And she just said, that's what they do. She was like, they won't tell you, but that's what they do. And I remember being like, yay, no, I don't think that's what I want. And then my cousin was like, listen, let your child be at home with mum and have one-to-one with you guys and do that. And let your child see you working. She said, honestly, it will be an education that people won't be able to buy. Like, she was like, tap into it. And my cousin really encouraged that. So then we said, you know what, that's actually true. And then when my mum said that she can help out part-time, it kind of felt like the best of both worlds. So I think it's really important for my daughter to see me as a woman working and, like, you know, us kind of making it work. And then my mum's going to have my baby from 1 till 7. And in the mornings, my husband and I are going to alternate each day. So like Monday, I'll be responsible for her. Then Tuesday, he'll do that. And then we'll keep going back and forth. And then on Friday, we'll alternate days who's taking care of her. And I think that's because it allows us both to have time with her. It allows us both to kind of parent her independently in the way that we want to. Because, you know, good parenting is kind of two individual styles coming together to be one. And I think that will give space for that to happen and thrive. And also, I think like the bar is low for men. Like, it's low. Like, so many people are so surprised that my husband's going to be like very responsible. Like, my husband does most of the nappies. Like, I'm not going to lie to anyone, sit and be like, I don't really do the nappies because I'm doing the feeding. So we've got to compromise. The bar is low. So like, my husband being hands-on is just the way it should be in my mind. Like, you know, I didn't make my baby by myself. You know, I did not. Like, it's not actually possible. So, you know, and also I think, if I'm completely honest, my husband's the eldest of four, and there's quite large age gaps. So like, his youngest sister is 13 years younger than him, so he's had a lot of experience in terms of child rearing. You know, he comes from a Nigerian family, so you know, he was like small daddy at home, if that makes sense. You know, like,
yeah,
he's borderline big brother, but he is kind of probably can be a parental figure when he needs to be. In a way, he's probably more naturally more maternal than I was from the jump, so I had to kind of learn it a little bit after him. So that's kind of it, really. Like, in terms of, I'm kind of a bit nervous how nurseries treat kids. And I'm also nervous how nurseries treat black kids. if I'm completely honest, I've heard some horror stories. So I want my child to be able to communicate with me, because if she says something's wrong, yes, if my child says something wrong at two, I'm holding you to account. I am that, like, I'm not here for it. Like, so yeah, we want our child to kind of able to, you know, judge that if she's come home from nursery a little bit, not herself, we can ask those questions and try and tease it out of her. I think that's why, like, we want to wait till she goes to nursery and between like 18 months and two part-time, and then having my mum fill in the gaps that we need. And we've been trialing it, because I'm working part-time at the moment and it's worked quite well. So yeah.
A part of our survey, we spoke to women like who were not mothers yet, as well as women who were, and some women who were not mothers spoke about the fact that they didn't really want to have children. And the reason why they gave was the state of the world, and like just being Black in the Western world, and kind of the anxieties and the concerns that they have about that, and then like bringing a child into that. What keeps you hopeful for your daughter's future?
You might be hearing my daughter, actually, she's screaming in the other room. I'm not gonna apologize for that, because it's a mum podcast, it's real life, guys. What keeps me hopeful? I'm gonna be 100% like Black ballads, like the work I do, like I know that I'm doing, like I know that I'm not waiting on anyone else to solve a problem. Do you know what I mean? Like I know that I'm doing work to better what life can be for Black women in my own way. And I hold my hands up and be like, Black ballad is a very small thing in the grand scheme of the world. It's like a tiny, tiny drop in the ocean. But I'm doing what I can. And that gives me hope. And I think the great thing about Black ballad is that I get to meet amazing other Black women. I get to work with amazing Black women like you, and like, I get to see how you're trying to make change in your own way. And I think, like, if my daughter can grow up around people who have become friends as well as colleagues, and like feel kind of, I guess, validated, because she's seeing other, not just other Black women, but other, even Black men, do you know what I mean, as well, thriving and not surviving, then I'm fine. I think, if I'm honest, but I think the also flip side is, when you do something like Black Ballad, you also see the other side of how bad it can be. You're not looking for the problem, but you're investigating the problem. So I just choose to keep hold of the positives of the work that I do and bring that home. I think as well, like, I've got a great family unit that really respect how we're trying to bring up our child and trying to kind of keep her engaged with her culture. But it's hard. And I think the reality is, bringing up a Black child is just very different to bringing up a white child. You know, she's only 4 months, but, you know, we are planning to move, and we're kind of thinking about, oh, what areas of schools and stuff like that. And a consideration, you know, I always say privilege is thinking society will work for you in the way that it should. That's privilege. And when you're Black, you don't have that privilege. You kind of have to think about how society won't work for you. So, like, you know, thinking about going to a school and wondering, oh, will she be allowed to wear her hair in a certain way? Like, stuff like that really makes me anxious. So every time I've seen like a nursery that's got like a Black head teacher, I make a note of it in my area, because I'm like, that could be a potential school for her if, you know, that head teacher's still around. So it's kind of, I guess, the work that I do, the people that I've met, the women, the Black women that I've met on this journey of doing Black Ballad, and honest conversations with family and friends who can help me bring up my child in the way that I want. And people are very respectful for the fact of the things that I want my child to have. Like, I've been very strict on her having certain toys that reflect her, and having certain books that reflect her. I had to tell someone that she can't have a certain toy because it didn't look like her. And that was just it. You know what I mean? So yeah, the work I do, having honest conversations with my family and friends, and just surrounding myself, I guess, with Black women who I feel are doing their part to make sure our Black children have the best shot at life that they can. And when I say Black children, I don't just mean Black girls. I mean Black girls and boys, because it's so important that both, as I say, don't survive but thrive in a system that doesn't want them to thrive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's so interesting when it comes to like making these decisions for your kids, and you start realizing, well, for me anyway, like, so much of it is dictated by my own experiences. So even we're having this conversation about moving at the moment, and I want to stay in London because I grew up being the only Black girl in class, and like, I don't want that for my kids. But then obviously my husband grew up in inner city London, and he knows what it's like being a black boy in London, so he doesn't want that for his kid. And it's like this weird like tightrope that you're trying to walk. Like, how do you create a future for your child that you don't, that you can only go based off of what you've experienced, but you're trying to create this future that you can't see yet, but somehow you're trying to make it happen.
It's you know, we did an event in Birmingham a few years ago, and I remember some black women came to the event, and one of them said, I've never been around so many black women. And I was shocked. I was like, oh my god, like, from school, like, I went to a school where it was majority black kids. This, people always find this really strange. So the majority of my teachers were black women. Like, my headmistress was a black woman. My deputy head was a black woman. My head of year was a black woman. My deputy head was a black man. My tutor was a black man. The whole science department was, like, Nigerian women. So, like, when people say they didn't have black teachers and stuff, I'm like, that's very strange to me. So I want my kids to kind of go to that school, because it gave me such confidence. I remember, like, my, you know, my teachers, I remember, like, my teacher I still keep in touch with. I remember one of them was like, you know, you are an amazing black girl who, when you grow up, the people that ignored you are going to be looking at you and being like, I wish I shot my shot, like, shot my whatever they say on Twitter with her, because she's really so amazing, you're intelligent. And like, I can't even tell you how that confidence as a child is something I'm passing on to my daughter, because obviously I didn't grow up with a black mum. So like, I had black maternal figures in school. So I'm so like, I must keep in inner city London to give my child the best chance of having so many black teachers growing up. And like, I'm like finding out that that's a novel experience. Like, that doesn't exist. Like, that was just like a really weird thing.
Yeah.
And the more I find that out, the more I find it hard to believe. Like, me and my best friends were talking about it, and it was like, no, all teachers are black, no? And I was like, no, like, this is just like strange. So yeah, like, it is that thing of like, you know, I don't think I'd ever move, because I think it's important for kids to kind, when they can, have the opportunity to be surrounded by like children who reflect their experience and can relate, or have, or at least have cultural empathy. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, my child might not have a best friend that's Nigerian, but like, even having someone that comes from a diverse background or like a community where there's a lot of diversity will no doubt help her be a better person. So it's an interesting one. I don't think we'll be moving out of London. My husband said he just can't, like, it's just a no. Like, it's just a no. He's like, why? Like, no.
But even like within London, like, just various different places, there's different kind of experiences. I live in Croydon, as you know, far away from everywhere. But my cousin, so I live in a bit of Croydon which is very multicultural, like all the primary schools, like when we were looking around the primary schools, like, loads of them have got black teachers, black male teachers as well, which I thought was really important for like my son to see black male figures in his family, obviously, but also outside of the family as well.
Important.
But then my cousins also live in the borough of Croydon, but if you go to their bit of Croydon, it's like completely different, like very white. They've unfortunately had like racist experiences at school and like in their neighborhood and stuff. So even like within London, just where you live, people will say that Croydon's like London. That's not the debate that we're having right now. But
okay, you told me, I won't debate you on it.
Yeah, so even like within the metropolitan area, just one little shift this way or shift that way and your whole experience will change.
It's very true. And also, like, I live in East London, so Borough of Newham, and like, it's completely changed since the Olympics. Like, you know, there's a social cleansing that's going on, and slowly I'm starting to see, you know, this is a borough that was majority like Asian and black and still is, but you know, I've lived in this borough, I was born in the hospital in this borough, I've lived in this borough my whole life. Like, I made my husband move here. I was like, I'm not leaving Newham. I love it here. I love the fact that, you know, I have easy access to everything. You know, it's so culturally like me. And I'm slowly seeing that, like, it's becoming whiter and whiter. Nothing made me realise that more so than when I was pregnant. I decided to go to Pilates, pregnancy Pilates. I did it in Forest Gate, and that's like predominantly been Asian and black as well. And I was walking past the houses, and I didn't even recognise it. And, like, even all the kids, like, I was walking past, a lot of them were white. And I was like, you know, like, white families, and I was the only black, I can't believe I did a class like that in Forest Gate and I was the only Black woman in the class. It was so strange. And I was saying that, like, it kind of felt like I wasn't in Newham. So even like what you say, like in this borough, like we're trying to make a decision, like, because we kind of want to stay in this borough, where we move to, it really can be the difference between our child seeing themselves regularly on a day-to-day basis or not. And that's a massive consideration. And I think kids are like sponges, like what they take in at this age, they're never going to be able to get rid of. So, you know, for us, we're really trying to, I guess, do our due diligence in finding areas that are multicultural.
Yeah, definitely. Gosh, all these decisions, it's always so...
So grown up.
So grown up. And like you said, like, privilege is just accepting that things are going to work out for you, for your good. And when you don't have that privilege, everything's like a double, triple think as yep. to looking at it from every single angle. Like, is it worth trading off this for this? Do we want to prioritize this over this? It's not easy. Even, I guess, I always think it's the best time to be a Black woman in the UK right now, but it's still not easy. There's still so much.
That's true. That's very, very so true. Much. You should put that on a quote card.
And start my influencer game. Okay, so what is something that has helped you thrive through like the difficult parts of motherhood so far?
I'm gonna say Black moms have definitely helped me survive this experience, and because sometimes you just need to talk to another mum that gets it. I've been on the verge of tears when I felt like I've worked too much. I felt bad when, like, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not read with her today. And people have been like, she's 2 months, chill. Like, she don't need you to read her. You know, when my daughter had this thing where she wouldn't sleep by herself and I thought maybe I'm not doing things right, or like, you know, breastfeeding was really hard. And Black mums, you know, have been amazing. As I said, like, the person I consider my big sister, she has helped me through this process, held my hand, guided me. She's got two boys of her own, and she just picks up the phone, and like when I've like needed to cry out or talk about things, she's listened. Bea Tajuddin, who I know is on the podcast, has been an amazing mum. I literally had an hour conversation with her last night on the phone, you know, about balancing like work that you love with, you know, having a baby, or on, you know, her daughter's not a baby, but just speaking to her, it's made me feel less guilty about working, and that it's okay, and it's okay if things don't work out in the world of work. Even seeing you juggle the boys in our meeting is just like, oh my God, you know what, it's not easy, but it's possible. It's not easy, but it's possible. So just being surrounded by Black mums, talking to Black mums, I think I even messaged you, like, what do you use on the boy's skin? Like, just being able to, like, just, and like, you know, another friend of mine, you know, tossing, I'm like, what do you use on your baby's hair? Just, you know, just having Black mums that I can just WhatsApp, text, or just pick up the phone to has helped me survive motherhood. But what has helped me thrive has been this podcast called How I Built This by Guy Raz. And it's a podcast that has entrepreneurs who have built amazing businesses and their journey, their struggle, their story. And, you know, listening to the women that are on those podcasts, many of them are juggling families. And, you know, they talk about it. I was listening to a podcast. He interviewed Jo Malone, and listening to her podcast was so inspiring. Very reflective of my own journey, because her business partner was her husband and they had a kid. And just talking about the struggles that she went through to build like this multi-million pound business that everybody knows has given me a fire of like, I want to build my business, and it's possible to do it with a family. It's not easy, but that has helped me thrive in motherhood, of like striving for what I want and what I want my life to be.
No, definitely. I hear that. So my final question is, what just gives you pure joy about being a mum?
Oh, that's so easy. What gives me pure joy about being a mum is just seeing my daughter smile. Like all babies, or she's kind of going into teething, but that gummy smile. Sleep train has been going really, really well. But me and my husband made a rookie mistake last night. We let her sleep till 9 o'clock and didn't wake her up. So at 3 a.m, my girl thought it was playtime. And I was so tired. But I could see in the dark that she was smiling and she was so happy. And like, she was so excited. And she just literally wanted to play. And like, I was even so tempted to go and get her favourite toy. to let her play. I was just like, you know what, yeah, my husband's not going to thank me for having this little butterfly that's rattling and making noise in bed. But just seeing her smile, like doing like, you know those things that I never thought I'd be, that mom that does those stupid voices and like tease her and like, you know, I never thought I'd be doing like baby voices and be like, excuse me to her and like making her smile. But it makes her smile so much. That gives me pure joy, just like seeing her smile and holding her. And I think she's been a great reminder of like, what is very important in life, and that it's okay to be still, because I'm always on the move. I think, you know, you work with me, so I'm always like, da-da! But she's the first person in my life that has given me joy from just being in the moment and still. And I think that's something that I feel in deep gratitude to her for.
That's it. We made it to the end. Thank you so much for listening to this first season of Black Ballad Presents The Survival Guide. A special shout out to all of those who have been listening from day one. And if you've rated and reviewed us in Apple Podcasts, we appreciate you so much. But if you haven't, please do so now. Share this podcast with your people. Let us know what you think on social media by tagging Black Ballad UK and using the hashtag BB Survival Guide. And if you're not yet a member of Black Ballad, you can get 50% off membership for 12 months using the code THRIVE. That's THRIVE. And I think that's everything. This series has been written and hosted by me, Jendela Benson, and produced by Christina Moore of Don't Skip.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.